I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Mark Lerenyoung joins me again. He has just published a new book, Orcas Everywhere, The Mystery and History of Killer Whales. Though written for a younger audience, the book is a marvelous overview of orcas and their place in this history, here especially, as well as a chronicle of the challenges then and into the future for these creatures. He also discusses the relationships we as humans have with killer whales, for better or for worse. He also writes in the book about his own experience with orcas, who he fell in love with at an early age. Mark Lerenyoung is a distinguished writer, documentary filmmaker, comic, podcaster, and orca activist. His previous book, which he was last on with, was The Killer Whale Who Changed the World. There's also a documentary called The 100-Year Whale. The radio documentary Moby Doll about the first killer whale in captivity was critically acclaimed. His previous books include Never Shoot a Stampede Queen and Free Magic Secrets, among many others. He hosts the podcast Scanna. This new book is from Orca Book Publishers, part of their new Orca Wild series. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Mark Lerenyoung. Mr. Lerenyoung, good morning.
Joe, thank you so much for having me back. This is so cool.
It's good to see you again. Congratulations on this book. I took this with me on vacation, and I enjoyed it a great deal. I got an ARC, which is, for people listening to us, it's, I guess, the draft of the book, and so it's not in color. I can only imagine, with the artwork in here, Ted Harrison, Robert Bateman, just what a beautiful book it is in real life, if you will.
I should have snuck you a proper copy, but it's pouring rain outside. It is amazing. The colors are amazing. The photos are amazing. I feel like you could take out my words and this would still be a fantastic coffee table book.
Yeah, and what I liked about it too were the pictures that you had, you and Rain, various travels that you've made over the years.
Yeah.
Not all for the book, but, you know, when whales are such a part of your life, both of your lives, I mean, it's a given that you're going to all these places, right?
Absolutely. Well, a lot of the photos were taken. We were touring with the 100-Year-Old Whale, which is the documentary made about Granny, the matriarch of the Southern Residence. And we just kept going to all the places where the whales are. So, yeah. So we've got, you know, a photo of Rain at Granny's Way in Friday Harbor, right, where they've named a street after Granny. And one of the bio photos we use is a photo of me next to all the dorsal fins in the Whale Museum in Friday Harbor.
Yeah.
And one of the coolest photos, like really, to me, my favorite photo spread in the book. I've been working with the Royal BC Museum, and they offered to rebuild the skeleton of Rhapsody. This is the orca who died in childbirth, and she's being featured in the big museum exhibit coming up. And Gavin Hankey, who's a friend of ours, is curator there, said, well, why don't we put the whale together for you?
Yeah.
So he put the pieces of the skeleton back together for us. And we were there with two students who were helping us with the podcast. And there's an image in the book, which it's cool in black and white. It's amazing color of the three of us. Basically, you know, head to foot, three people, to give you a sense of how big this small whale is. And I mean, I don't come from a science background, so I'm staring at the skeleton going, those look like fingers to me, right? I'm looking at him going, oh my God, we really did. Like, you start to look at this and go, okay, how evolution blows my mind.
Yeah.
And working with the museum, one of the things that's happened is I'm working with like their paleontologists, and they're going, you know, orcas like were up on land and then they went back into the water. I'm like, that just, I'm going, no, you're just hurting my head now, seriously. But seeing what sure look like hands and fingers is just mind-blowing. But also just the size. The other cool thing was we were basically back in the bone room. So anything else you want to see? I'm like, yes, I would like to see a narwhal tusk.
Yeah.
And I'm holding a narwhal tusk, and I thought, okay, if ever I could just be Gandalf, like, I'm holding this thing. There have to be magic spells in this thing if you know the right words.
Yeah.
Because narwhal tusk, it was just so surreal. But everything about that was amazing.
It's a remarkable place, isn't it? We go there. I mean, we really go there at I guess elementary school, or high school. I guess those of us in this part of the world, we take the boat and go over there and spend the day. But I did that recently, 2-3 years ago, and I mean, I can't get enough of it.
I have always loved it. My dad worked at the BC legislature, and back when kids were allowed to do things on their own, I would visit him in his office. And then when things got boring, I'd go, can I go to the museum? And the museum used to be free. So I would just go and I'd hang out in the old town and explore it.
Yeah.
Or I'd walk through the dioramas and go, oh my God, that's a woolly mammoth. That's so cool. You know, so I've always loved that museum.
So this exhibit that you just mentioned, when does that open?
It's called, the exhibit's called Orcas, Our Shared Future, and it opens May 15th. And I've been lucky enough to have been working on it the last year or so. So very excited about watching it all come together, and amazing to see what goes on behind the scenes to bring a museum exhibit to life.
And it's a reason to go, I guess, May 15th, right?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. All summer. So I expect to see everybody from Vancouver is going to show up next summer to check out the Orca exhibit. It's really cool.
So you were 5 when you first saw a whale.
That's the best guess, because my mom used to take me to pretty much, my brother and I, to pretty much anything cool that was going on, and scan it happened, the Vancouver Aquarium. So that's where parents were taking their kids.
And it's beautiful to read in the book that how you describe what that was like, and how, I hate to use the phrase, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that it changed your life, didn't it?
It really did. Well, I mean, seeing whales up close, pretty much any animal up close and staring long enough, it's hard not to be really enchanted. And the orcas always got to me. I mean, just always impressed and knocked out. And I mean, I remember my goddaughter went and saw a whale, and she was like 3 years old. And for 15 years, she wanted to be a marine biologist.
Really?
That one encounter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it really is life-changing when you catch these creatures at the right moment. I mean, the other one, to be honest, I also quite obsessed over the octopus there, because the octopus hid so that the octopus had something going on. I would just stare, going, where is it hiding? What's it up to? I don't think it wants to be here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the octopus always rocked my world, because I'm like, oh, there's something going on. You're an alien.
Yeah. I was just thinking, too, you know, you're talking about the narwhal tusk and then the bones. You get a sense of just how big these things are.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it's funny. Laying down next to Rhapsody, just realizing this is huge. And this is not a big orca.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the things I did was hang out at the Beatty Museum underneath the blue whale skeleton.
Uh-huh.
And you just go, this is epic. And one of the largest creatures ever on Earth. And you just go, these are still here. This is mind-blowing. But, yeah, and I, growing up in Vancouver, I was a Greenpeace kid, right? Like, I have memories of my brother drawing in crayon the Rainbow Warrior as a kid. So, you know, really grew up going, okay, what's this all about? And, you know, growing up in Vancouver, it's hard not to grow up wanting to save whales, not trees.
The reading your book, Orcas Everywhere, I learned a lot, which is, you know, a good thing, because kids are going to read this and they'll learn a lot. The other thing I was thinking about as I was finishing it, there's still much to be learned about them. I mean, there's a mystery about them, isn't there? And I mean, you've been obsessed with this since you were 5.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there is stuff that you would like to know that you don't.
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the things, okay, I get into this a bit in the book, and this is one of the reasons that it was fun to write a kid's book and fun to be told I could have the freedom to write about whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really hit me as I started to interview orca experts for the movies, for the books I was doing, and for the podcast, is almost every single person I've spoken to has a story they're almost embarrassed to tell because it is fictionally implausible.
Yeah.
Right? If you talk to any of the orca experts long enough, almost all of the people who have decided to devote their lives to working with these orcas, to studying these whales, have some astonishing story about how they met them. And Alexandra Morton, who is amazing and who's now doing all the work vetting fish farms, her initial passion was orcas. Her initial passion was cetaceans. And, you know, she told me a story about being out on the water, being lost in the fog, and a pod of orcas showing up and basically leading her back to safety. And that was the first and only time that a pod did that with her, was the one time she was lost and wasn't sure how she was going to get home. Ken Balcom, who runs the Center for Whale Research, told me a story that was so identical, I had to go back through my notes to see if I was hallucinating, that both these people had almost identical stories. And with us, Rain and I went out to film Granny. We were doing our film, The 100-Year-Old Whale, which is a biography of Granny.
Uh-huh.
And it's on CBC Gem now, if anybody wants to check it out in Canada. It's on Vimeo if you're outside of Canada listening to this. And we went out. We were told Granny's really hard to see right now. Nobody's running into her. She's basically traveling with another orca and about a mile from the pod, so we're not usually spotting her. So maybe if we see her this summer, we'll give you a shout. Half an hour later, I get a phone call, like, how fast can you get to the boat? And so Ray and I are at another event. We actually raced to a drugstore so that we've got something in the camera to film. You know, we've got an extra card in the camera. And race out there. And Eagle Wing Whale Watching takes us out privately and says, look, there's another boat out there. And they said they're keeping an eye on Granny for you.
Yeah.
Because we really want this movie to happen. So there are four people on the boat. There's Rain, there's myself, there's Brett, who runs Eagle Wings, the captain, and there's Clint Rivers, who's a wildlife photographer, has been working for 20, 30 years, taking photos of orcas and bears and pretty much everything. And we show up, and the moment we are anywhere near Granny, she greets us with a couple of tail slaps like, hey, where you been?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, just on cue. And then a moment later, she basically does a spy hop, again, right in front of Rain's camera. Now, if you've ever been whale watching, you know that whales also have this mysterious ability to go, oh, your camera's pointing that way? How nice for you. I'm going to be right over here. Oh, you're watching where I was? That was so 30 seconds ago. Yeah. So anybody who's ever been out there knows that, you know, the orcas and cameras, good luck.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know this from the people who photograph and catalog them, that it's crazy making. And nope, but Granny's going, oh, yeah, Ring, that's great. Good to see you. I'm going to spy hop right in front of you. And it is twilight. It is what filmmakers call magic hour. Perfect, beautiful, orangey sunset. And every orca in J-Pod is behind the boat, and Granny's off to the side. And behind the boat is like the most magical picture, postcard photo of orcas you've ever seen in your life. And Rain's going, can I please take that shot? Can I please take it? I said, I don't care if the whales behind us start to hula. I said, keep your camera where Granny is. And a moment later, Granny does this amazing breach out of the water, flies out of the water, and you can hear Brett and Clint, who've both been watching these whales for 20-something years, go, and they suddenly, 4-year-old girls, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's Granny, it's Granny, it's Granny, it's Granny. And then you can hear me really softly muttering, tell me you got the shot, tell me you got the shot, tell me you got the shot. Then Granny does a second breach a moment later, before the camera could even refocus. And at this point, Brett and Clint are turning to us going, okay, now she's just going to juggle salmon for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently, they'd seen Granny breaching me 3 or 4 times ever before this.
Yeah.
And here she is on camera, we're making a movie better. So after that, I just assume it must be easy to get these shots.
Sure,
so I reach out to the Center for Whale Research. I said, so can we get all of your footage of Granny breaching? Any footage I reach out to all of the other experts. So can we get all of your great footage? Oh, we don't know if we have any. Seriously. So this one day when we shot this, Granny's there. The next time Rain goes out in the water, and I don't regret a lot of things in my life. I regret that I was not on this boat.
Yeah.
She goes out, and there's a super pod greeting ceremony, which, again, people who've been out 20, 30 years have never seen. and it's where the orcas from different pods line up and greet each other, and you just go, okay, this is a gathering of the clans. This is the kind of ritual that you go, seriously, tell me that, you know, you can't watch this and not go, this is an intelligence, this is a culture. It's impossible.
It's something altogether. I mean, it's spiritual. It's you know, you do talk in the book about the intelligence. I mean, the size of their brains and how complicated they are, intricate they are, I should say. I mean, it's a species altogether that I mean, we've been trying to, as we've talked the last few minutes, to define them, if you will. But, I mean, it's impossible, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the thing. It's like, rains out. She gets a super bot greeting ceremony. And it's like, oh, you're making a movie about us. Let's make sure we got this covered. Last summer when Taliqua was carrying her calf for 17 days, this is the orca who was grieving for her calf, for her dead daughter. Ken Balcom, who's been watching the whales just kept for the last 30, 40 years, just went, this is a message to us. And never a moment of doubt for him that this was for us.
Yeah.
This was, look at what you are doing to my community. Look at what you are doing out there. And the more time I spend around the orcas, the more convinced I am that it is insane that they don't have some degree of rights like we do.
Yeah.
You know.
The thing that I was thinking about as reading the book is how much you learn about people.
Yes.
Through them. And unfortunately, in the time that we live in, we're learning about the bad that people do.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what is that like for you? I mean, it is obviously a critical time. It is a time where something has to be done, and you talk at the end of the book about the things that we can do in our own homes and what we can do. We're in the midst of an election now. You know, big issues usually come to the fore. We talk about those things. Saving the world, I mean, as someone, I mean, you're incredibly optimistic. I mean, do you ever lose that?
Trying to remember who this quote is from, but I like, it's a beautiful quote, hope is the only moral choice. Right? And man, I'll remember this since we're off the air. Somebody Google it in show notes or whatever. But it seems almost wrong to give up hope. And with the Southern Resident Orcas, I know there are people who've given up hope. They're down to 74 in the wild right now. And I look, and there are populations that have come back from worse places than that. But we have to actually make an effort. And it's been interesting realizing that's a cross-border effort. And Rain and I were speaking at Superpod, which is the big gathering of orca lovers that happens every 2 years down in Friday Harbor. And it covers everything. It covers captivity. It covers orcas in the wild. It sort of came originally out of Blackfish, and a lot of people are involved in that. And we discovered that almost nobody in Washington State even had Kinder Morgan even had the pipeline on the radar. But we knew almost nothing about the Snake River dams. And basically talking to the orca experts, what they keep coming back to is if we can breach these dams, the lower Snake River, that there's a chance to bring back the Chinook population, which helps bring back the orca population. And it was fascinating watching as Washington State, basically Tahlequah shamed governments in Canada and Washington State into doing or appearing to do things for the orcas. But the one thing everybody was asking for was breach these dams, get us more salmon. And that's the one thing they're backing off on because politics is nasty.
Yeah. Reading your book made me think of just what a beautiful part of the world this is. I mean, talking about Washington State, talking about the coast going up north as well.
Yeah.
In British Columbia. I mean, we live in such a beautiful, remarkable place.
Oh, we really do. And, you know, getting to watch the orcas has been a gift on that front. Like, I spent a lot of time on Saturna Island to research the book about Moby Doll and also just hang out on the whale trail and hope the whales show up and watch. And it's just, you just start to appreciate how amazing this is.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd never been to Saturna, which is like population 300 and something. Yeah. And what a gift to be able to hang out there.
You talked about some of these museums that you went to around the world. Where else can one find orcas?
In some cases I went. In some places, I just interviewed people, and they are everywhere. They're in every ocean, but it's all different ecotypes. And ecotype basically, it's interesting, ecotype basically is the word for, hi, it's a new species, but it's complicated to declare new species, so we'll call them ecotypes.
Yeah.
Because declaring a species, I gather you need specimens and things like that. Yeah. And so it's complicated, which is really dumb in the age of DNA, but I'm not a scientist, so I'll leave that to them.
Yeah.
But there are 13 or 14 different types of orcas. And it's been wild getting to know more about them. So I was at the Whaling Museum, not the Whale Museum, mm-hmm. in Norway, in Sandfjord, Norway. And, you know, it's wild because they've still got the skeletons and they haven't treated them quite the way we have here. So if you touch them, you can still feel the oil. And these are not recent skeletons, but the way they were saved, you know, wow, this is amazing. It's a little wild. And, you know, we went out on the whaling ship that the Sea Shepherd had sunk, which is now one of their major exhibits. So you can go out there and see what a whaling ship looked like. And that's wild because Norway's still a whaling culture, right? And I had an interview with the head of the Whaling Museum. He said, oh, yeah, nobody eats whale anymore. It's not really a thing. And my cousin translated the word whale vol for me, and we'd walk past butcher shops.
And see it.
And see fresh, basically fresh vol, fresh whale. Yeah. And we went to the restaurant around the corner from the Whaling Museum, and there was a minke rocket salad. There were like three different dishes with minke whale. I'm like, okay, this is so surreal.
Yeah.
Right. Because coming from here, and the craziest conversation, I've got a cousin who's like 22, 23. And I said, you know, something, basically I was asking her, did she like whales? And her English is okay, but not great. So she went, oh yes, seared with lingonberry sauce. And my jaw drops. I'm like, oh, she's not joking. And then I talked to somebody, you know, who ran the ship, you know, who was the main tour guide for the whaling ship. And he said the same thing. Oh, yeah, seared with lingonberry sauce, but you can't overcook them. Right? I was just like, okay, different world. Right?
Yeah.
Just a totally different world.
And so in terms of conservation, in terms of population, is there something we can learn from the Norwegians, say, that we can bring to this coast, if you will?
Well, it's interesting because the orcas seem to be doing fine there, but there are lots of herring there. It's all about food supply, right? So, you know, some of my favorite photos in this book were taken in Norway, and they are orcas chasing herring boats. So they're tracking the herring boats down. That was actually where I had kind of a breakthrough working on this, was asking the Norwegian experts. I was like, okay, can you tell me what the names are for orca or killer whale here? And one of the names was signpost. And it took me a bit to wrap my head around it. Again, this is a conversation in sort of slightly broken English.
Sure.
And the gist of it was that here in a lot of parts of the world, we've seen the orcas that really earn the name killer whales, the orcas that eat other whales. But there are orcas that only eat fish. So in Norway, they've only got the fish eaters, or what we would call the residents out here. So as far as they're concerned, orcas are these big things that you follow, and if you follow them long enough, you'll get to the herring.
Right.
So they are signposts. The dorsal fin is a signpost to the herring, where in other parts of the world, they are the wolves of the sea, they are killer whales, they are variations on monsters or demons.
That's the other fascinating thing about the book was you talked about how they were perceived in popular culture. Melville and Moby Dick, obviously. You know, you know, the idea that they're called killer whales, I think, I mean, that set the scene for a lot of people without even having seen one, right?
Oh, it really did. Well, the one of the craziest things I found when I started researching Moby Doll, who was the first killer whale in captivity, displayed in captivity, and this was the Vancouver Aquarium. This is how I ended up obsessing. Mm-hmm. Was when Moby Doll was caught, the night Moby Doll was caught, CBC Television News reported the Vancouver Aquarium had captured a monster. Mm-hmm. That was the word, monster. And that was, so July 16th, 1964, killer whales were monsters. Within a few days of this whale being in captivity, Moby Doll was Vancouver's beloved pet whale. And the shift was amazing. And part of, you know, talking about hope and optimism, part of that, my hope and optimism is going, okay, I just did a deep dive into how public perceptions globally shifted in a span of a few days.
Yeah.
Because we got to know this orca. And I watched what happened with Tahlequah last year, where people around the world went, okay, something is wrong. We need to help these orcas.
It was at the top of the newscasts.
Yeah, it was
every day.
Top of all the newscasts every day. I don't love where we went and didn't go with that, but at least it happened. I look at how quickly blackfish changed the world on captivity.
Yeah.
So I really do feel that we can move the dial, but it's about changing people's hearts,
yeah.
Right? That's part of writing for kids. It's going, okay, you know, if I can get young readers, young people caring about these orcas, you know, look what Greta Thunberg's done in climate change.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's a girl who started, she's 12 now, but she started when she was 9, London Fletcher, and I talk about her in the book. And she's an awesomely compelling speaker. And she speaks out in Washington State and talks about the importance of the Southern residents. And people listen. So I'm a big fan of getting young people to speak out.
What was it like to write for a younger audience? I mean, it's different than writing for a general audience, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what was amazing to me was asking what words I could and couldn't use, because I really wanted to get into the concept. I really wanted to get into some heavy concepts of the book.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
And I said, how do I do that? And basically my editor said, just explain the words. Right? Just, if you're using a big word, make sure you explain the bigger word. So that was interesting. I've actually written for young audiences before. I used to do a lot of theater for young audiences, mm-hmm. mostly for teens. And I've written television for all ages. I've actually written preschool television, which is really hard.
You
can't use your words,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
So you're telling a story, for the most part, non-verbally. So I wrote a lot of episodes of a show called Toy Castle that ended up on PBS. And I love the challenge of it, but it really came down to use shorter sentences. It was interesting. It wasn't about the size of the words. It was about the size of the sentences. Apparently, the younger you are, the harder it is to follow too many clauses and, you know, all the ellipses and, you know, M dashes I love to use when I'm writing.
But what comes through, though, in the spare words that you invoke, is the enthusiasm that you have for orcas. I think you wrote this in the book, I'm trying to remember now where, that if there are school groups in this part of the world that want you to come in and talk to them, you're happy to do that, right?
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun. I've been so lucky to get to talk about orcas to different classes because of the movie, and you know, I'm trying to finish off the Moby Doll documentary now at long last.
Yeah.
And just getting to have these conversations. And again, the questions from young people are fantastic. I did a talk where I was screening the 100-year-old whale and had one of the young people in the audience drew this beautiful picture of Granny for me. And I talked about how Granny had a nick in her dorsal fin, and that was how you could tell her apart. So she drew me several orcas, and one of them had a little nick in her dorsal fin. She's like, that's Granny. I'm like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure people ask you, kids, as well as people of all ages, what we can do. What do you tell them?
Oh, it's funny. On the West Coast, Snake River. It's interesting that, you know, I became more of an activist for orcas because of the pipeline. And at the moment, yes, I worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
But in some respects, now that we're down to 74, that's almost the existential threat. The real threat right now is they need food. They really, really, really need salmon. And the people who've spent their lives studying them just keep coming back to the only way we get more salmon quickly is to breach one of these dams. And, you know, we've also got to clean up the Fraser.
Mm.
Right? There are all sorts of things that we're doing that we're trying not to pay attention to. And we've got to fix the Fraser River. We've got to deal with our own pollution. We've got to deal with our mess. So it's, yeah, taking responsibility for our garbage and getting that there is no away. We're not throwing things away. We're throwing things into the ocean.
Yeah, yeah. And you do give us some tips in the back of the book as to what we can do to reduce our impact in our daily lives, which is important, isn't it?
One of the things that Rain and I've done is she's been working on a website, orcaseverywhere.com, where we're trying to share all the extra information about what people can do, links to all the different groups. Because one of the big things that I realized, and this came out of my theater work with John Giuliani, who was my mentor, was to him, the play was the start of the conversation. It was never the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
And that always stuck with me, and with almost everything I've done, I've tried to make sure the conversation could continue. So when I did my movie The Green Chain, I think you may have interviewed me about that a jillion years ago, I started a podcast so the conversation could continue around that. The Scanna podcast started about continuing the conversation around Moby Doll and the 100-Year-Old Whale, because people kept calling me up and saying, oh, we've got this great story, you've got to tell it.
Yeah.
For who?
Yeah.
Right? You know, there aren't that many markets for freelancing about orcas. And so I started the Scanna podcast. And with this, I thought, we need a place for people to go where they can find out more about what they can do. And again, to go beyond the book and have the conversations beyond the book. So orcaseverywhere.com, we're just going to steer people to this is this organization, this is this organization. Here are the different things that you can do. Here are the different threats to the orcas. Here's how you can help.
And if you go to that website, there'll be obviously a link to the Scanna podcast. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
One of the upcoming guests you've got is Robert Bateman, I understand.
Yes, that was so much fun.
Yeah. What does he think about orcas?
He actually said something I quite loved, which is how amazing they're still on Earth. Right? Like, what a gift that we've still got them.
Yeah.
And that really stood out for me. And one of the things that knocked me out talking to him is I love that he describes himself as a naturalist and an artist. And it's like he almost always uses naturalist first.
Yeah.
And that's pretty darn impressive when you're, I guess, arguably Canada's most famous artist, well, most famous living artist.
There's a short clip on a recent episode of, I guess, a preview of this longer conversation that you have with Bateman. He talks about just how important they are to the ecosystem, and that we do lose sight of that, don't we?
Oh, we really do. And a phrase that kept coming up when I started interviewing experts was canary in the coal mine.
Mm.
And the idea that if we can't keep these orcas alive, it does not bode well for us. And it's a little terrifying when you start to realize that orcas are being disposed of as toxic waste because they have so many pollutants in their system. And it's horrifying to realize that part of what they're dealing with is pesticides and chemicals like DDT that we got rid of 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And they're not gone, right?
They don't just disappear.
They accumulate. And they accumulate in the orcas. And, you know, the idea that you have to dispose of certain orcas as hazardous waste is mind-blowing and horrifying. And does not say nice things about how we've treated our planet.
He talked also in the short clip that I heard about sound pollution. Just as important as, I guess, you know, when they ship this stuff, the things through the water. Sound pollution, I mean, you have from recreational boat users and the sort. And, what sort of damage does that do to an orca?
That's a tough one because, you know, if you look at the photos I've been finding of, like, the Norwegian orcas, they're going right next to the boats.
Yeah.
You know, so in the grand scheme of things, it really does come down to the fish over the acoustic pollution. You know, the bigs orcas, the transient orcas, they're coming up again right next to boats because they're going after their prey. So the big issue is prey availability, and the acoustic pollution is kind of next level. It's like where I'm going, okay, absolutely. Am I worried about the extra tankers from the pipeline?
Yeah.
Yes. Right now, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd wave that magic wand and take out the Lower Snake River Dam so that we had salmon.
Yeah.
And that would be the first thing that I'd deal with. And one of the things that people, I think, don't realize is they assume there's somebody out there watching these orcas all the time. There isn't.
Yeah.
So what we're running into now with the new limits around how close you can get to the orcas, and this is, again, coming up from the researchers in Washington State, they are really worried that what's going to happen is we're going to lose a whole bunch of orcas due to ship strikes.
Yeah.
Because recreational boaters don't watch. You know, I mean, think of the people who are going out on their boats on a Sunday afternoon who go out, you know, what, four times a summer or whatever. And if they don't see those whale watchers, they don't slow down. Mm. We saw that video clip that went viral a while back of the boater just whipping through a pod off Stanley Park.
Yeah.
And I gather that's what's being witnessed on a regular basis now in Washington State, where the whale watchers just going, fine, you know what,
yeah,
this is too much grief, we'll watch the humpbacks. You don't have the person there who's doing anything to slow people down. And the groups that are assigned to the groups that do watch the orcas have no authority to do anything. And that's been a fascinating thing that I discovered,
yeah,
is that, great, we've got all these wonderful laws. There is no enforcement. The only boaters who are ever going to pay a penalty for going too close to an orca are the official whale watchers. No, you really want to make sure that if a recreational boater does what that person did at Stanley Park, and that person, there's photos, there's images, there's video footage,
yeah, yeah.
And I had a call into the DFO going, okay, who's been charged?
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah.
So why isn't that person up on all sorts of charges of endangerment? Because we're not wired for it. We actually don't have a system set up to catch, prosecute, even do a decent fine.
Right.
Our animal rights laws are kind of brutal, right? Like, it's, you know, they aren't a huge deterrent in terms of hurting animals. We see that with hunters as well.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, the cost of a fine for hunters is less than they paid for the helicopter to go out and shoot the animal. That's insane. The cost of the fine should be so freaking prohibitive that if you do something bad to a wild animal, you know, I'd be all in favor of jail time.
Right.
Right? But that doesn't exist.
So. On whale watching, because, you know, you go through the airport or you go through the bus station, you see all those pamphlets and the sort for them. You do have to do your research in terms of which firm you go with in the sort, right?
Oh, absolutely. I was, Rain and I ended up with Eagle Wing because that was the company that Ken Balcom, who runs Center for Whale Research, said, no, they are, you know, doing all they can to be eco-friendly. They're mm-hmm. aware of the whales. I don't know if I've ever gone out with them when they didn't have a researcher from either the DFO or University of Victoria or somebody there doing genuine research work. And, you know, it was interesting because I met people on the boat who were working there who had worked with different organizations and are just going, no, this is where we feel good. But there are others, like there, we were out once and somebody was flying a drone over one of the orcas and the captain on the Eagle Wing boat said, do you have GPS on your camera? I said, yeah. He said, can you please film that? Because we're in Washington waters and NOAA will enforce.
Yeah.
over the drones. Canada at that time, and still Canada at that time, and I don't think, still think this is the case. We don't have any enforcement around drones. So, and this particular whale watching boat, which was using drones, apparently has lost their whale watching license a jillion times, and so they declared themselves bird watchers. The fact that there are no birds and they just happen to be flying a drone 10 feet over an orca doesn't deter anything. And again, it's horrifying to me that there are bad actors out there who we're aware of and no enforcement around those bad actors.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd love to see enforcement of the actual rules that we've got.
Yeah.
Whatever the limits are, I'd love to see actual enforcement. I'd love to see authorities out there. But it's wonderfully complicated because when all of that money was kicked in to make sure that, you know, we were watching the orcas, there didn't seem to be quite as much kicked into, and now we're going to send some people out to watch behaviors and monitor behaviors. And I'd love to see that happen, and I'd love to see really significant fines, enforcement, whatever, of people who actually are endangering those orcas. Like, I really want, I want to pick up the paper one day and read that that person who whipped through that pod in Stanley Park is facing criminal charges.
Yeah, that's the thing about regulation. I mean, we're living in an election era, going through an election, and you know, it's a buzzword. You know, it's something that people will use to reduce regulation, but in certain instances, more is needed, isn't it?
Well, actual enforcement would be
right.
Kind of unique.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the wild part, is that in theory we have regulations, we just don't have enforcement. And again, same thing with pollution, right? What fines do we actually enforce when we find these polluters? How often are they genuinely taken to task? We've got, you know, tailing ponds or whatever, mines dumping their garbage, and nobody's really... It's rare for there to be fines that can't be written off as cost of doing business.
What about aquariums? Where do you fall on aquariums?
It depends on the aquarium. Depends what they're doing.
Like SeaWorld in San Diego. Would you go to that?
No.
Yeah.
Not with what SeaWorld's been doing.
Sure.
It's been interesting because I feel like I know a very different Vancouver aquarium than most people do now, because the people I deal with at the Vancouver Aquarium are all researchers.
Right.
Right? So, I was fascinated when Peter Ross, who is the top marine mammal toxicologist in the world, and he's the person constantly consulted on what is, you know, the dangers facing orcas and cetaceans around the world. And he was fired by the Harper government for doing his job and saying these whales are toxic. And he now works for the Vancouver Aquarium. So to me, the Vancouver Aquarium is Peter Ross, and the Vancouver Aquarium is Lance Barrett Leonard, who's one of the top researchers in the world of aquaculture. So it's really interesting seeing how they're trying to, and in the process of rebranding, to focus more on rescue, which I think is really valid, and research. And it was interesting, even doing the historical research, and this came from early conversations with Paul Watson when I first dove into this, and reading the work of Eric Hoyt, who was doing work on orcas way back and did some of the first work on captivity, was the Vancouver Aquarium was one of the only places doing actual research. That said, I haven't followed all the stuff around them and belugas because I was just deep diving into orcas. And
Yeah, I asked about aquariums because it can be a consumer choice for a lot of people,
oh,
right?
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, people, you know, after reading this, might be interested in seeing various species and the sort. You really have to do your research in terms of what a facility, whether it's a, you know, the big ones in the United States or ones closer to home, as to what they've done over the years, right?
What they've done, what they're doing, what their mission and mandate are, you know, I mean, that's so not what you want to do when you're on vacation. You just want to go, this is the cool thing that's happening.
Sure.
But it's, Yeah, it's like everything else. The world gets really complicated when you start to do a deep dive into your choices.
Yeah. Another fascinating thing in the book that I enjoyed reading about is the language that we use, the grammar that we use in terms of how we describe orcas. You do have to anthropomorphize these things, don't you?
I'm really big on that.
Yeah.
And when I sent the first draft of my book, actually pretty close to the end draft of the book, to Eric Hoyt, who's written more books about orcas than anybody else in the world, as far as I know, and I just interviewed him. He's also coming up on the podcast for me, and he's amazing. And he's been studying the orcas since we first started studying them in the 70s. And he looked at my title and he said, it was originally called The Killer Whale. That changed the world. And he said, you know, my only real suggestion for your book is change it to The Killer Whale. Who changed the world?
Mm.
And I was so glad my publishers let me do that, because it changed, that one word changed so much about what the book was about, and really changed my way of thinking. Just that one shift where you start to refer to them as who and not that. And you start to look at these orcas as beings and not possessions.
Right.
And one of the things that comes up the more research I do is, in most indigenous cultures, orcas are viewed as relatives.
That's how they talk. Yeah.
Where, you know, as opposed to resources. And I'm much happier with the idea that orcas are our relatives and orcas are our neighbors than orcas are resources.
So you're obviously very busy with the release of this book as well as the podcast. Are there other projects that you're working on at the moment?
I'm actually working on a play about whales for Boca de Lupo because I love them.
Uh-huh.
So working on a new play. It really does feel like all whales all the time right now. I've got two new kids' books coming up that I'm just finishing off. What happened was Orca saw this book and went, you're really comfortable writing for kids. Would you write for littler kids? I went, sure. So I did a picture book and a board book that are almost done. Those are going to come out in the spring. So, you know, that was, again, really a fun challenge, going, okay, what language can I use now that we're taking this down a few grades? What language do I use when I'm writing basically for babies with a board book?
Yeah.
And that was just so much fun to do. So it's, lots and lots of orcas.
And it must be, it must be gratifying to know that these books are being read by parents to young people who really need to read this stuff, right?
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, I like that if they get inspired, they'll inspire us.
Yeah.
Because we listen to kids.
Yeah. It's so nice to see you again. I really hope this book does well, because it's a book that people need to read, and it's an important, critical time. And I think we all, regardless of our age, need to read this.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for doing this and for all the support that you give writers.
Well, I appreciate it. And thank you for bringing buttons. That's what people do now. They bring buttons. And so that's the fun part about doing this.
Nice.
The book is called Orcas Everywhere, The Mystery and History of Killer Whales. It's published by Orca Books. Go to orcaseverywhere.com for more information, and obviously the podcast, Scanna. Mark Lehrenjung joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponta.